The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the special report headline, 2019 Corporate Philanthropy Awards. It takes much more than dollars and cents to establish a vibrant business ecosystem. This year's class of winners put community first as giving, caring, and engagement took center stage for these individuals and companies. And we'll just read a sampling of the articles. First, Campbell University, Norman Adrian Wiggins School of Law, description of nonprofit, provider of legal education. What has been your biggest accomplishment in the past year? Campbell Law supported a wide array of efforts designed to enrich the education of its student body while serving deep needs in the community. The school's dozen-plus pro bono service programs included the Campbell Law Innocence Project, the Child's Advocate Project, Child Permanency Appeals Project, Death Row Visitation Project, Domestic Violence Advocacy Project, Reentry Project, Veterans Project, and Service Animal Project. What is the nonprofit's ultimate mission, and has that mission changed over the years? In 2018, Campbell Law's four community legal clinics served at-risk members of Greater Raleigh through the Restorative Justice Clinic, Senior Justice Clinic, Stubbs Bankruptcy Clinic, and the Blanchard Community Law Clinic. How does your board help the organization with its goals? We have a board of visitors that meets each semester to help identify opportunities where we can improve as an institution to serve the community and better equip the students to become practice-ready community leaders. What is your biggest charity event of the year? How much did you raise, and how do you typically spend the proceeds? We do not rely on an annual fundraising event. Instead, our situation as an academic institution challenges us to think creatively each semester to identify specific programs or projects to highlight throughout the year based on the needs of the organization. A recent example involves the law students having a charitable golf tournament to raise funds benefiting the North Carolina-based nonprofit Victory Junction. In your opinion, what percentage of the money raised each year should go into the program services? We don't fundraise on this traditional model that a program-based nonprofit must do. Given our basis as an educational institution, we raise funds for both operations and program services. For the program services, we typically have all the funds raised going to support such items. If you had to pick one individual or one company who was a game changer for you last year, who would that be? Campbell Law's Blanchard Community Law Clinic partners with nonprofit agencies in the community, including Alliance Medical Ministry, Step Up Ministry, the Raleigh Rescue Mission, and Urban Ministries, to provide solutions to legal problems encountered by clients by those agencies. The clinic, launched a little over 2 years ago, made a tremendous impact in the community in 2018. The Blanchard Community Law Clinic has handled 192 cases, including expunctions, family disputes, domestic violence protection orders, and landlord-tenant issues. The clinic has secured at least one monetary settlement as a result of a landlord violating the Fair Housing Act. Legal services are provided by Campbell Law students and under the supervision of Clinic Director Ashley H. Campbell, handle cases with a high level of independence and conduct client interviews, prepare motions, oversee case management, and make court appearances. Through this experience, students gain important practical legal skills and an appreciation for the challenges faced by citizens living in poverty. First Tee of the Triangle, description of nonprofit youth development organization that focuses on bringing the game of golf and the values inherent to people ages 5 to 18. What has been your biggest accomplishments in the past year? Over the past year, our organization is most proud of our new partnership with 13 Wake County Public Elementary Schools. In our first full year of delivery, we saw our drive for success grow to near 500 kids, and we now employ 49 teachers to help us with implementation. Early data indicates that students in these programs are improving in their confidence, respect, and social skills with peers. What is the nonprofit's ultimate mission, and has that mission changed over the years? Our mission is to impact the lives of young people by providing educational programs that build character, instill life-enhancing values, and promote healthy choices through the game of golf. How does your board help the organization with its goals? Our board does a great job of supporting our organization through strategic thinking, advocacy, and financial support. Most recently, our board is playing an integral role in executing our vision to create the First Tee Center for Youth Development, a safe haven facility for youth in our community to have a place to play and receive mentorship. What is your biggest charity event of the year? How much did you raise, and how do you typically spend the proceeds? Our biggest event each year is our Night Four Champions, spelled F-O-R-E, presented by Town Bank and in conjunction with the SAS Championship. This event happens on the Wednesday of Tournament Week at the Angus Barn Pavilion. Past guests have included Bernard Langer, Colin Montgomery, Miguel Angel Jimenez, and Hale Irwin. In your opinion, what percentage of the money raised each year should go into the program services? Ideally, organizations should allocate as many of their donations as possible to direct program services. However, traditional overhead percentage should not be the key factor in nonprofit performance. Prospective donors should evaluate organizations based on sound governance principles, the quality of the infrastructure to create and maintain sustainable and impactful programs, and most importantly, the outcomes that an organization generates. If you had to pick one individual or one company who was a game changer for you last year, who would that be? Peter Millar, led by Scott Mahoney, have been a true game changer for our organization. Their support of our mission on an annual basis, their significant capital investment in our Center for Youth Development project, and Scott's personal willingness to advocate to others on our behalf have truly raised the bar for what we can accomplish as an organization. And we'll stop there and return to those articles if there's time at the end. Now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Triangle Pharma companies spend millions on lobbying. Lobbying dollars by Big Pharma have been increasing steadily in recent years, and Triangle area companies are no different, dropping millions in 2018. According to data released by OpenSecrets.org, a Washington, D.C. government watchdog, pharmaceutical and health product companies spent nearly $282 million in 2018 on lobbying activities. 5 years prior, that total was $227 million. Looking back 20 years, the industry only contributed $69 million. The largest sum came from the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, which spent $27.9 million in 2018. Topping the list of big spenders are companies with massive operations in the Triangle, including Pfizer, Merck, and GlaxoSmithKline. Based on the number of employees, the area's largest pharmaceutical and biotechnology companies together spent about $40 million, according to the report. In both the Triangle and Nation, Pfizer holds the record for most money spent on lobbying efforts as a single company in 2018, spending $11.4 million. Other major companies with Triangle presences include Biogen, which spent $3.2 million, and GlaxoSmithKline, which spent $4.5 million. Meanwhile, Equivia, a contract research company with a major derm presence, spent $330,000 in 2018. Chimerix and BioCryst, two derm drug development companies, spent $130,000 and $90,000, respectively. The North Carolina Biotechnology Center spent $200,000 on lobbying efforts, according to the report. Shop with French Flair looks to remember D-Day. The 75th anniversary of D-Day is June 6, and a Raleigh store is looking to commemorate the occasion with mementos from the time. Des Livres et Delices, a store at Five Points that's spelled D-E-S-L-I-V-R-E-S-E-T-D-E-L-I-C-E-S, a store at Five Points that features French books and food, is asking for artifacts from World War II, and especially from D-Day. The store plans a special event on June 6th to have the exhibit from June 6th through the 10th. Allied forces landed in Normandy June 6, 1944, and the U.S. Army entered Paris on August 25. Kerry Golf Tournament supporting soldiers. In their eighth year of working with the U.S. military, the folks putting together the Majestic Four U.S. Troops Golf Tournament at Prestonwood Country Club in Kerry did something different this year. They moved the tournament from the day after Memorial Day to the week after the holiday, June 3. Why? Officials say because of higher engagement with the community. We have raised almost $1 million, and all the proceeds have gone to individuals serving the military, says Arun Singh, a tournament chairman. This year, we are also donating to Charles Ainsworth, the Raleigh policeman who got shot preventing a robbery in January. The tournament's title sponsor also changed hands, with Youngsville-based Majestic Kitchen and Bath Creations taking over from EDM's U.S. unit. This golf tournament always had a different feel because of its mission to help folks in the U.S. military, says Scott Byers, Majestic CEO. We want to be involved and grow this cause because in the end, we know we can spread this generosity in our communities. This year, the sold-out event is honoring the U.S. Army's James Napier, Anthony Von Cannon, and Andrew Walker, and the Marine Corps' Ryan Cooperus and Jeremy Austin. Seen in the crowd at the Paul McCartney concert, there were plenty of well-known faces in the crowd when Paul McCartney played PNC Arena on May 27, but one head that towered above others was former UNC Chapel Hill basketball player Warren Martin, who is 6'11". Martin was seen on the concourse with Deborah Crowder. She is the former assistant in the African and Afro-American Studies Department who was at the center of the academic scandal at Carolina. Crowder has kept a low profile since retiring in 2009. Raleigh firm gets a look from NASA in tech contest. NASA is showing some interest in the technology from Raleigh's Wiser Systems. NASA, in an effort to draw interest from tech companies that might not otherwise be thinking about outer space applications, held a pitch competition, and Wiser Systems was one of 10 finalists. Wiser develops an instantaneous location and tracking technology, sort of ultra-high-end GPS. The company was founded by CEO Elaine Rideout in 2011. A panel of NASA experts will review the 25 semifinalists based on their relevance, likelihood of success, and potential impact. The 10 finalists will be announced by May 28, and those 10 companies will meet with NASA leaders and potential investors at the NASA iTech Cycle 1 Forum in Pasadena, California, July 10 through 11. The top three teams will be selected there. And finally, Rocky Mount has a novel idea and is thinking small. Here at Biz, we love how Eastern North Carolina is looking to revitalize itself, and so it's fascinating to hear about a new project in Rocky Mount. River and Twine, a tiny home hotel at Rocky Mount Mills, will open to the public June 1. The boutique of 20 homes will sleep up to 4 guests and cost $129 nightly. You can sit outside around a fire pit and enjoy s'mores or drinks with your fellow neighbors, or walk across the street to hang out at the mill. Rocky Mount Mills is home to 5 breweries, a brewery incubator, a bottle shop, and 3 restaurants. The homes include Wi-Fi, microwave, TV, cable, internet, dishwasher, and a coffee maker. Just watch your head going to sleep at night. The ceiling in the loft sneaks up on you. Rocky Mountain Mills is owned by Raleigh's Capital Broadcasting. And now we turn to On Startups, Tech, and Transportation, written by Lauren Onasorge. Person County optimistic about Megasite. Recent news that Cree is expanding its manufacturing operation in Durham is validating for an effort nearby, and one that, if all goes well, could mean a 4,000-job chip operation in Person County. Certainly, it brings more awareness for our area being a candidate for that sector, says Sherry Wilborn, interim economic development director for the county. For years, economic development officials have been trying to sell major semiconductor companies on a 1,300-acre site, one located between 2 Duke Energy power plants. And they've received major interest, such as by Global Foundries, which had initially contacted Duke about the site more than 6 years ago before shifting their plans. When Global Foundries' interest waned, so did Person County's recruitment efforts, at least on the surface. Behind the scenes, the county has been working to make the site more shovel-ready, and those efforts are paying off. We've been marketing it for years, but I would say our efforts with that have picked up as we've gotten more boxes checked off, she says, pointing to an under-construction water line and gas utility lines. In January, the county filed an application for a permit from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and in a response letter sent back this month, the Army confirmed it had received 6 written comments from state regulators and other parties. Wilborn declined to talk about the status of discussions with individual companies, but did confirm the USACE paperwork is on track, and we're certainly encouraged by the announcement from Cree and the work that NC State is doing, she says. The county plans to heavily market the site, which recently obtained megasite status, at an upcoming industry conference in California, SemiCon West. Seth Thomas Gulledge writes the On Healthcare and Education page in the Triangle Business Journal. His first article, Drug Maker, $100 Million Fundraise Possible. A stealthy Triangle pharmaceutical company has brought in $5.6 million, adding to $21 million in prior investments and clearing a runway for it to bring its candidate to market next year. Marius Pharmaceuticals, a Raleigh-based drug company developing an oral testosterone replacement therapy, has announced a $5.6 million fundraising round in which 16 investors participated. That funding is the second for the company, which was launched in early 2017, thanks to a $21 million fundraising round led by Shaw Capital, a Raleigh-based private equity investment fund with about $300 million in assets under management. Shaolin Shaw, Marius's CFO and the Director of Private Investments for Shaw Capital, says the newest funding will finance Marius through the remaining Phase 3 trials of its lead candidate. Shaw says the drug is based on the work of the company's scientific leadership, all former GlaxoSmithKline researchers. Shaw says the company has already seen promising data, which received orphan status from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and expects to submit a new drug application in the first quarter next year. Following that, the company plans to make an ambitious play, morphing into a full-fledged commercial operation to market the drug. Shaw says the company believes independently commercializing the drug is more advantageous than other exit strategies. The key is the expansion beyond. I think we see indication expansion with this asset, he says. Precision Strike's $50 million credit deal to add more funding just months after its IPO. Just months following the company's $130 million initial public offering, Precision Biosciences has announced a $50 million credit agreement with a West Coast bank. The Durham-based drug maker is looking to develop its Arcus genome editing platform to produce treatments for cancers and genetic diseases. It began trading March 29. Still building up its coffers for the drug development ahead, it has entered a loan and security agreement with Pacific Western Bank, in which the company can request advances on a credit line of up to $50 million. Under the terms of the agreement, Precision paid $25,000 up front and is required to pay 0.5% of the unused portion of the credit each quarter. That fee will be waived during any quarter in which the company maintains a balance of $25 million at the bank. Interest rate for the credit is set at the greater of 1.25% below the prime rate, or 4.2% when the company has a $25 million deposit. If it does not have the sufficient deposit, the interest is set at the greater of 0.25% above the prime rate, or 5.75%. As of March 31 and prior to its IPO, the company reported $116 million in cash and cash equivalents and 127 employees. As of the end of 2018, the company had an accumulated deficit of $85.2 million. UNC research could help control diabetes. Research coming out of UNC Chapel Hill has the potential to create a smart insulin that could reduce diabetic patient complications and significantly change how patients manage their condition. The findings were published in a new study led by UNC researcher Zhen Gu, who recently left the university for a professorship at UCLA, and Dr. John Buse, UNC's director of the NC Translational and Clinical Services Institute, NCTRACS. According to initial findings, in mice, the eye insulin automatically releases when blood sugar or glucose levels rise and shuts off when glucose levels fall, effectively regulating itself. Specifically, the insulin works like a key, docking with receptors that work like a lock that allow sugar to enter fat and muscle cells. When glucose levels are low, the insulin binds to glucose transporters and remains inactive. When glucose levels rise, the higher glucose competes with the insulin for glucose transporter sites and results in insulin being released into the bloodstream. This particular type of smart insulin is just remarkably creative, Buse says. But Buse cautions that the method is still in preclinical development, but says if realized, it would be one of the most exciting advances in diabetes care. The study was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. At Triangle Emergency Units, patients wait longer than United States average. Few people are happy while waiting in an emergency room, but federal data show the average Triangle resident is spending more time waiting than the average American, unless they're at the right hospitals. According to data released by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services for a period of 2017 to 2018, the average amount of time before a U.S. patient is seen at an emergency department is 22 minutes. The average time until a patient is admitted as an inpatient is 332 minutes. In North Carolina, it takes 28 minutes to be seen at an emergency department and 331 minutes to be admitted to a hospital. Those waits are getting worse at emergency departments. In the 2016 to 2017 reporting period, the state averaged 26 minutes, joining a larger national trend of busier hospitals with more inpatients. The situation is not better at the Triangle's largest health systems, Duke Health, UNC Healthcare, and Wake Med Hospitals. The average time before a patient is seen by a healthcare professional is 26 minutes. The average time they spend in an emergency department before being admitted is 364 minutes, more than a half hour longer than both the national and state average. Duke private practice compete for carry projects. A major health system and a private practice are both proposing to construct endoscopy centers in Wake County, furthering the ongoing competition for patients in the western reaches of the county. Duke Health and Wake Endoscopy have both submitted Certificate of Need, or CON, applications with the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services to build new centers. The state regulatory process requires medical providers to submit their projects for state approval and often are competing for a limited number of allowable space. But in the case of endoscopy centers, the state does not limit the total amount allowed, meaning the two applications are not in competition with each other. And now we turn to On Real Estate, written by Cliff Barnes. Project seeks approval for 40 stories. Another high-rise is being proposed in Raleigh, and this time as part of a transit plan. Raleigh's multimodal transportation center plans will get a boost if a rezoning request for a mixed-use facility regional bus transit station is approved. The Research Triangle Regional Public Transportation Authority, GO Triangle, is asking that its 1.76-acre property on West Street be rezoned to allow for a proposed bus transit station to be up to 40 stories high. The contiguous properties are at 200, 206, and 210 Southwest Street. The applicants, represented by the Parker Paul Law Firm, say that the property is already designated as being part of the Central Business District in the future land use map. That document states that this should be a primary district for the core mixed use of downtown, where heights can reach as high as 40 stories. The bus station would be adjacent to the new Raleigh Union Station, but it will be more than a simple bus station. The proposed rezoning includes residential uses, including affordable housing. The property owner will dedicate no less than 20 units as affordable for households earning 80% area median income or less for a period of no less than 10 years from the date of issuance of the certificate of occupancy. The application reads, while no other specific uses are noted, it's clear that the building would afford multiple uses. The proposed rezoning will also include a vertical mix of uses, the density of which will help support a vibrant downtown retail environment. The application reads, just last week, Zimmer Development filed paperwork to seek approval from the city to build a 40-story mixed-use development off Capitol Boulevard. And earlier this year, Williams Realty and Building Company filed a rezoning request with the city seeking to increase the height limit for the project to 40 stories. Current zoning allows just 12 stories. Meanwhile, notes from a neighborhood meeting on the proposal indicate that office spaces could take up part of the Transportation Center building, which would be built somewhere between 20 and 40 stories. More medical office buildings targeted for growing carry market. The demand for medical office buildings is continuing to explode, and now more are coming to carry. Three new medical office buildings, or MOBs, are in various stages of development, including a 45,000-square-foot building on Kildare Farm Road that figures to be 100% occupied when it opens in late 2020. Jim Few, owner of the James Company, is developing 1700 building at 1700 Kildare Farm Road next to Fellowship of Christ Church and will have a shared parking agreement with the church. Few is a veteran developer who started developing MOBs in the Triangle area in the early 1990s. He is one of the investors who bought the 3.62-acre property in 2017 for $1.7 million under the name DBO Investments, LLC, with an eye toward building a three-story medical office building. Donald Hanna is listed as the registered agent, while attorney Barry Mann of Manning Fulton is listed as the organizer of the LLC. 2 years ago, I had the opportunity to be involved in purchasing one of the last tracts of land near Wake Med and saw this as an opportunity, Few says. In the last 30 years, the MOB market has continued to grow despite recessions, lack of capital, etc. The one common denominator is the aging population and the growing need for medical services. Two other MOB projects near the Wake Med Hospital are in the works. Few was part of a partnership that built the Medical Park of Cary, the first medical complex built near the hospital. It was sold to the Arizona's REIT, or REIT, Healthcare Trust of America in 2010. In 2018, Healthcare Trust announced plans to redevelop Medical Park of Cary, including construction of a new 125,000-square-foot building. Tenants should start to move in by mid-2020. A second phase of the project could bring the size of the medical park to about 225,000 square feet. At 1700 building, doctors can purchase or lease space, an option Few says is not commonly available in the market. Rates are still being determined. Major New York firm grabs Triangle Apartments. An Atlanta firm is cashing out after developing an apartment complex in the Triangle. Davis Development of Atlanta bought the land in 2015 for $2.3 million and completed an upscale four-building apartment complex on the property earlier this year. Davis Development has now sold the property for more than $41.4 million to a large New York-based real estate private equity firm. The Blackstone Group, which has $140 billion of assets under management, purchased Adara Alexander Place at 7610 Aura Loop in Raleigh. The property is located between Highway 70 and ACC Boulevard, just north of Raleigh-Durham International Airport. The 14 acres, situated between a Walmart store and the Crest at Briar Creek apartment complex, have an assessed value of $2.8 million, while the buildings, which hold 202 apartment units, have an assessed value of $27.5 million. The 216,000-square-foot apartment complex features nine floor plans across one, two, and three bedrooms that range from 661 square feet to 1,471 square feet each. Prices average more than $1,500 per month. Developer looking to build new homes in Fuquay Varina. The push for new homes in fast-growing Fuquay Varina is continuing. A subdivision with 199 single-family lots could be coming to northern Fuquay Varina if a recently submitted preliminary plan is approved. The property at 3528 Wiltree Drive is owned by the Sugg Family Limited Partnership, Rebecca Sugg Smothers, according to county records. However, it was the Triangle-based Royal Oaks Building Group, a division of Mattamy Homes, that made the proposal for what it calls High Grove Oaks. The open space development would be built on about 68 of the 92.53 acres, with the lots averaging 11,592 square feet. The other 24 acres are deemed as open space. The land has been assessed at more than $2.9 million. Town officials say there is no timetable for approval. It's early in the process, and staff will review the plans for as long as it takes to ensure compliance before presenting the project to the town board for final approval. And the last article on this page, SECU, looks to expand in Raleigh with land purchase. The 20th Raleigh branch of the State Employees Credit Union could be coming soon after the purchase of 4 acres of land. Located near northern campus of Wake Technical Community College, the State Chartered Credit Union, headquartered on Salisbury Street, bought the vacant property at 7725 Midtown Market Avenue for $4 million. Commercial Properties Realty Trust of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, which bought more than 250 acres in that area from private property owners for $30 million in 2007, were the sellers. Commercial Properties, using its 5401 North LLC, recently petitioned the city of Raleigh for annexation of nearly 6 acres of property nearby at 7780 Midtown Market Avenue to be used for a restaurant and 2 office buildings. Existing incorporated areas are contiguous to the site, which intersects with Perry Creek Road. And now we turn to A Better World in the Triangle Business Journal. And first we read the column written by Lori O'Keefe, who is president and CEO of the Triangle Community Foundation. The headline, Good Advice on How to Get Started and Remain Sharp. This month, a whole new class of leaders traded final exams for the workplace, and I had the pleasure of speaking to some of them at NC State University's Nonprofit Miners and Social Innovation Fellows graduation. I wanted to share some of my address because sometimes all of us, no matter how long our career has been or what field we work in, could use a reminder of how we can translate what we do into meaningful work. For those of you about to enter the nonprofit field, I'd ask you to reflect on this. How can you ensure that future generations are thought of today? What can you do in your life, in your work, as you move into this sector to create a legacy? How can you be that person of integrity who works to ensure the world is better for having had you or your organization in it? How can you translate that into meaningful work that will positively impact not just one or two, but 7 generations to come? I have some advice for you to consider. Find a mentor. There are 1,800 nonprofits in the Triangle alone. Most of them are led by caring and visionary leaders who were once where you are today, and they thought the counsel of others. And they sought the counsel of others. We understand that, and we understand that it's important for us to pay it forward. Find someone who will be a sounding board, a cheerleader, a course corrector, a challenger. You will need them all at some point, and sometimes you need them all at once. Understand how to read a budget. I'm still surprised by the lack of financial acumen that comes with basic accounting. Often, especially in smaller nonprofits, the resources are put toward programs and fundraising, and maintaining good financial controls is secondary. In this ever-competitive space, ensuring you are working at a sustainable organization with sound business practices is critical to the organization's and your individual financial well-being. Network with your peers. It's easy to get buried in the details of your work and to forget there are networks of people who can help provide some perspective. But you never know when you'll need a shoulder to lean on, an ear to listen to, or just someone who gets it, because this work can be so different and sometimes isolating. I have several peer networks, from my alumni cohort to the group of nonprofit CEOs who meet monthly. Serve on a board. Understanding how to work effectively with your board becomes a much easier prospect if you can understand what it means to serve on a board. It's also a great way to balance the work of your day job with the work that fuels your soul. For instance, my work at the Community Foundation requires me to be a generalist and understand the Triangle's entire nonprofit ecosystem, which is an inspiring way to spend my day. But I feed my passion for a more tangible connection back to the arts by using my volunteer leadership toward those organizations. And finally, take care of yourself. This work is hard. It's rewarding, but it can be filled at times with stress and uncertainty. Many of us who have chosen this path have done so because they want the social good as a key component of our careers, and yet it is that same love of humanity that may cause us to sacrifice ourselves for the cause. You can't do the challenging work of leading systemic change or helping individuals and communities improve their well-being if you aren't well yourself. Burnout is a thing in any sector, but it's particularly prevalent in the nonprofit sector. A career in the nonprofit sector has brought me tremendous fulfillment, and I couldn't imagine doing anything else. Regardless of your career path, know that your care of the sector and your integrity give me hope and comfort for my generation and my great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren's too. And in the nonprofit notes, Blue Cross NC launches medical membership program with YMCA. Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina has launched a pilot program with the YMCA of the Triangle, the NC Alliance of YMCAs, and the North Carolina Medical Society Foundation, providing medical memberships for eligible enrollees. The program is funded through a three-year investment of $1.5 million that will subsidize memberships to all YMCA locations in Wake, Durham, Orange, Lee, and Johnston counties. Blue Cross NC will pay a portion of an individual's membership. The YMCA will waive joining fees for participants. Medical members will pay a $25 copay each month. As a practicing physician, I know how critical comprehensive integrated care is to a patient's overall health, said Dr. Patrick Conway, president and CEO of BCBSNC. This pilot program is an important step toward transforming healthcare in our state, lowering costs, and providing our members with proven, effective programs to improve their health. The memberships will be prescribed to patients who have an identified health risk or clinical diagnosis such as prediabetes, hypertension, weight management needs, cancer, or the risk of falls due to age or illness. BCBSNC hopes to eventually offer YMCA medical memberships throughout the state. NC Independent College Fund raises $3.2 million. Closing its 2018 to 2019 fundraising campaign, the Independent College Fund of North Carolina has raised $3.2 million. Director Colleen Kinzer said the campaign brought in $505,820 in scholarship support, $360,987 for student enrichment programs and other grants, and more than $2.3 million in in-kind gifts. We are so grateful to the 130 donors and sponsors who contributed to this year's campaign, he said. The amount raised for programs included $69,950 for the annual Ethics Bowl. SAS provided more than $2 million in donations of software and training support for 31 participating campuses. Raleigh twins start business to help seniors with tech needs. Two Raleigh high school students have started a tech company designed to help seniors. Jacob and Adam Baines, who are 18-year-old twins, got the idea while helping their grandparents with questions on their tablets. Their company, called My Smart Grandkids, provides seniors and retirement communities with tech mates on site, young adults who help the seniors with questions about technology. For example, the Cypress of Raleigh uses a TechMate once a month. Presbyterian Homes recognized for programs. The Presbyterian Homes, a group of retirement continuing care communities in Cary, Colfax, and Laurinburg, have received the Leading Age NC Excellence in Community Service Award. The group is being recognized for its service programs at each of its communities, including in Cary, in which residents provide tutoring for children of staff members and even staff members themselves. The program was started by a resident as a way to share her passion for learning with the younger generation, said Paul Gregg, executive director of the Cary community. Once other residents saw the impact of the program, more and more wanted to be involved. It really speaks to the character of the people that live in our community, how vibrant they are, and how they are always willing to help others. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Private Businesses Should Consider Selling. If you have a business that generates a decent flow of revenue, this may be the time for you to consider selling. After receiving the latest numbers relating to mergers and acquisitions activity among middle market companies, it is hard to believe owners of these businesses would not consider selling, even if the thought of letting go has not crossed their minds. But if these owners of private businesses tallying $100 million to as much as $2 billion in annual sales look at the buyer's available pot of money, they may regret their decision later. More than $1 trillion of private equity is currently available to outfits looking at high-quality assets generating gradual sales growth across broader markets. While the 2019 M&A activity has not been as robust as last year, at least for now, there is more money available to do deals thanks to the tax reform, and the premium for good companies is off the charts. Last year in the Triangle, about half of the largest M&A deals were executed by public companies such as Martin Marietta, Red Hat, Cree, Ply Gem Holdings, and First Citizens Bank Shares. Because of the general northward direction of the stocks, these companies often use the appreciated value to add sales, margins, and market penetration. Conditions are so favorable right now that dealmakers want to close deals as fast as they can because they know the inevitable. Markets will turn around and the money will dry up. Of course, any M&A is generally bad news for workers. Big companies with international trade exposures already have begun to lay people off. In the triangle, the latest was Lenovo, which announced the cutting of 500 jobs. That includes workers at the large Research Triangle Park operations. But let's look at the other side of the equation. The owners of these businesses are often starting or investing in smaller ventures with the windfall that leads to hiring of new workers to scale up operations. This phenomenon of too much money chasing too few deals does not only benefit middle market companies, it elevates the valuation of small businesses under $50 million too. And therein lies the opportunity for the majority of Triangle businesses operating in industries such as technology, professional services, and healthcare-related products and services. If there's a company in the Triangle that has managed to expand its product and service offerings across more and more markets in the recent past, it's time to review the enterprise value of the company and explore opportunities. Buyers are looking for deals that can be rolled up or scaled up fast because the most important element in business right now is time. It almost feels like deal makers can hear that invisible clock ticking, and everyone is gunning to add heft to their portfolio. For sellers, if they are not paying attention to the market right now, they may repent later. And also on the Viewpoint page, we'll read a column written by John Hood, who is chairman of the John Locke Foundation here in Raleigh. The headline, Federal Funding Harms State Policy. When North Carolina governors and lawmakers talk about the state budget, they rarely tell you the whole truth. It's not that they're trying to deceive you. They're simply speaking a kind of political shorthand that unfortunately fails to convey the full breadth and cost of state government. Our state budget contains several discrete funds with their own design, function, and revenue sources. Last year, they totaled $54.5 billion in expenditures. Some $23.9 billion of that, or 44%, consisted of the general fund. It receives the proceeds of state income taxes, sales tax, and other levies, while housing state expenditures on education, human services, public safety, and general government. The general fund is what politicians typically refer to as the state budget. It's obviously of great importance and interest, but the general fund encompasses less than half of the state budget. Federal appropriations, 28%, highway funds, 7%, and programs funded by other taxes and fees, 21%, account for the rest. For the sake of both accuracy and accountability, policymakers and those who report or comment on their actions should be more comprehensive in their presentation of fiscal data. North Carolinians can't make informed decisions at election time or engage effectively with public officials in between elections if they aren't getting the full story. In particular, by focusing so much on the general fund, our current discourse about the state budget obscures the large role that federal dollars play in state government. During the immediate aftermath of the Great Recession, for example, general fund appropriations fell. But state government simultaneously received significant increases in federal funding, largely offsetting the overall fiscal effect, although not necessarily the effect on specific agencies or programs. The consequences of federal funding going far beyond the immediate fiscal effects, however. What Congress appropriates, Congress must first expropriate. If you're a North Carolina taxpayer, you're also a federal taxpayer. While the net flow of funds may be positive to our state at a given point in time, especially if direct expenditures on federal installations, such as military bases, are included in the calculation, North Carolinians are no less on the hook than all other Americans for the massive borrowing binge both parties have been on in Washington, D.C. In other words, there's really no such thing as free federal money for states. It's costly in more ways than just the obvious. Chris Edwards lists some of them in a new research paper for the Cato Institute. One dynamic is called the flypaper effect. When Congress creates a new grant in aid program for states, Its offer of federal money entices state legislatures to spend additional dollars of their own on the same things, often in the same way. If you think politicians and bureaucrats in Washington always know best and that there is just one best way to solve public problems, then this flypaper effect shouldn't worry you. If not, it should. Another related problem is the extra cost states incur for handling complex federal grants. Here in North Carolina, a new report by the General Assembly's Program Evaluation Division took the administration of Governor Roy Cooper to task for squandering lots of time and millions of dollars in ineffectual efforts to deliver federal aid to victims of Hurricane Matthew, which ravaged a significant swath of the state in 2016. For one of the programs in question, North Carolina had spent only 1% of allocated federal funds through the end of 2018. Cooper's officials defended themselves in part by challenging some of the division's definitions and interpretations of existing law. As you can see, even seen in the best possible light, the episode illustrates how involving multiple levels of government can prove cumbersome and confusing. The Cato Institute paper concludes, and I agree, that federal aid ought to be a much smaller share of state budgets. Americans want more responsive and effective government, Edwards writes, which requires devolving power to the states and reviving competitive federalism. Actually, we'll go back now and read some articles we missed by Lauren Onasorge in the On Startups, Tech, and Transportation section. Advance Auto touts new deal with Walmart.com. Raleigh's new Fortune 500 company is on track with its game-changing partnership with one of the world's biggest retailers, Walmart. That's according to Advance Auto Parts CEO Tom Grieco, who said on a recent earnings call that the partnership between the two companies means a huge opportunity for his retailer. We're building an automotive specialty store on Walmart.com where our customers will have access to our parts, accessories, maintenance items, he said. We believe we can bring speed, convenience, and trusted advice to the large number of DIY customers who are already going to Walmart.com every day. Advance Auto Parts, which is relocating its headquarters from Virginia to Raleigh, saw its net sales increase 2.7% to $3 billion in its first quarter. And its new partnership and other technology initiatives like it promises to drive more revenue, said Grieco. The goal is to get started in the front half of the year. RDU loses international flights to Caribbean. Raleigh-Durham International Airport is down 2 international flights as its fastest-growing carrier partner just stopped 2 nonstop services to the Caribbean. Colorado carrier Frontier Airlines confirms recently launched flights from RDU to both Punta Cana, Dominican Republic, and Montego Bay, Jamaica are no longer active. In the case of Punta Cana, it's a seasonal suspension, meaning the flight is likely to return next season, says Zach Kramer, Frontier spokesman, in an email. But that's not the case for Montego Bay, whose route has concluded with no current plans to return, he confirms. According to Kramer, it comes down to poor demand for the service. Frontier had just announced the flights last June. Carpe Lotion entrepreneurs add another $3.5 million. Over the past 2 years, a Durham startup has been raising millions of dollars in cash, but not to solve some high-tech software conundrum. The co-founders of Clutch Incorporated, which does business as Carpe Lotion, have a more embarrassing, closer-to-home problem in mind: sweat. This month, they closed on an additional $3.5 million in equity, bringing their funding over the past 2 years to more than $6.3 million. Co-founder David Spratt declined to comment on the recent funding, but it appears they've acquired expertise along with equity, as the securities filing disclosing the round now lists Seth Radwell, CEO of the Proactive company, as a director, a name absent on previous funding documents. Carpe Lotion is on store shelves at 8,000 CVS stores, and the firm is working on deals to expand its distribution to other major retailers. ABB fights data breach lawsuit. A pair of ABB employees are trying to bring a class action complaint against the Swiss industrial manufacturer, alleging that a data breach compromised personal data for thousands of people participating in its health benefits plan. But ABB claims that despite a data security incident in 2017, there's no evidence personal information was used by the purported hackers. Lead plaintiffs Ricky Kimbriel and Paula Kimbriel filed suit against ABB, which has both its Americas headquarters and a major research operation in the Triangle, in the Eastern District of North Carolina. They claim the breach, alleged to have impacted nearly 18,000 employees and their families, caused stolen identities and ongoing aggravation. In a statement, ABB claims that after identifying the breach, it took immediate and comprehensive steps to address it, and that its steps helped protect employees and dependents such as the Kimbriels. ABB worked closely with the appropriate regulatory authorities and engaged identity monitoring services for impacted employees and dependents. The statement, emailed by spokesman Christopher Shigas, reads, "We believe our efforts protected our employees. It is important to note that to date, there has not been any specific evidence suggesting that any individual's data has been accessed or used in any way. We therefore disagree with many of the allegations in the lawsuit and intend to defend against it vigorously." The Kimbriels, via the 26-page lawsuit, claim they spent substantial time and money to protect themselves and their data. While hackers using a phishing scheme are alleged to have compromised plan account data, including Social Security numbers, in August 2017, ABB did not acknowledge the breach or notify plan participants until September, the suit claims. And in news around the state, home prices in Charlotte area once again post slower growth. This article is written by Jenna Martin. The rate in which Charlotte area home prices are accelerating fell again in March. Local home price gains increased 4% on an annual basis in March, down from upticks of 4.2% in February and 6.2% recorded in March 2018, according to the latest S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller Home Price Index released May 28. The Case-Shiller Index tracks changes in the values of single-family homes across the U.S. It is based on a rolling three-month average of repeat home sales, homes that have sold at least twice. Despite the downward trend, the 4% annual price growth in Charlotte's housing market remained higher than the national increase of 3.7%. It also remained higher than the gains experienced by the 20-city and 10-city composites of 2.7% and 2.3% respectively. All three of those measures were lower in March from the previous month. The patterns seen in the last year or more continue. Year-over-year price gains in most cities are consistently shrinking. Double-digit annual gains have vanished, said David Blitzer, managing director and chairman of the index committee at S&P Dow Jones Indices, in the Case-Shiller report. The shift to smaller price increases is broad-based and not limited to one or two cities where large price increases collapsed. Las Vegas, Phoenix, and Tampa, Florida had the highest year-over-year gains in home prices at 8.2%, 6.1%, and 5.3%. Greensboro struggles to bring parity to city-funded projects. Between 2012 and 2016, companies owned by African Americans received just 1.08% of contracts for work on City of Greensboro construction projects. That's $3.18 million out of a pool of more than $295 million. Add to that professional services, goods, and other services, and African American-owned businesses received $13.33 million out of a potential $738.5 million. Asian Americans, Native Americans, and Hispanics each received less than 1% of contracts awarded by the city across all categories, according to a study conducted by Atlanta-based attorney and public policy consulting firm Griffith & Strong. About 94% of contracts went to companies owned and operated by white males in the period captured in the study. Quite frankly, we have dismal numbers when it comes down to looking at what we've spent in city contracts with minorities and women, says Greensboro City Councilwoman Sharon Hightower. Griffin and Strong's is the third such disparity study, Hightower said she has seen from the city, and each contained similar findings. Neither resulted in real change, she says. That's because there was no political will to see a change, Hightower says. It doesn't happen because, quite frankly, people just don't give a darn, she says. And in the small business section, there's a column written by Mark Pentecost, who is the founder and CEO of It Works Global. Seven common drains on a company's resources. A company's resources are often thought of only as its product and supply. There's much more to it than that, though. A company's resources can include time management, production, and even staffing. After more than 17 years as a CEO, I've seen a lot of practices that work and some that don't pan out as well. As a member of your company's executive team, it's important to be aware of some of the most common drains on your company's resources. Production waste. While product waste is bound to happen, excessive waste can severely reduce your margins. Know how much and exactly what is going to the trash before your product makes it to consumers' hands. Evaluate your measurement systems to ensure accountability and create standards to get those numbers down. Warehouse management. Whether it's an oversupply of product in warehouse storage or an inefficient process for how the product leaves the warehouse, the executive team needs to be aware of what's happening with your products before they reach the consumer. Double work. One of the benefits of our huddles is that they reduce instances of multiple employees and teams working on the same thing and coming to the same result. That's wasted time and money as well as a major drain on your company's resources. The worst excuse I hear from team members is, "That's how it's always been done," after identifying an inefficient practice. Encourage your team to think brainstorm ideas to save time and reduce overall workload. Inefficient time management. How much time does your team spend attending unnecessary meetings and waiting because someone is late? Every meeting should have an agenda shared with all participants before the meeting begins to decrease those inefficiencies. Too much too soon. Growth is an expected and necessary part of any company's journey. However, taking the leap to expand your company before you're ready can cause more than simple growing pains. It can lead to a loss of talent, credibility, and product. Don't jump blindly into the next phase of your journey. Make sure you and the rest of the executive team are ready for the next steps. And we'll stop there as the last two drains on company resources are unnecessary expenditures and talent management. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138.